Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour this morning, Hugh Gusterson.
It's a pleasure to be here, Janice.
Well, as an academic anthropologist, you've carried out research for years on militarism, securitization, and nuclear policy. And you're the author of a number of books on atomic weapons and the nuclear laboratories, including Nuclear Rights and People of the Bomb. I first learned about your work some time back when you gave a lecture based on your studies as an anthropologist of government nuclear laboratories. So it's delightful to have you on the show today to talk about Christopher Nolan's new film, Oppenheimer. Nolan's biopic traces the rise of this American theoretical physicist, Robert Oppenheimer, as he rose during the Second World War to direct Los Alamos and the lab there in the direction of the Manhattan Project, and his tragic decline during the McCarthy era. So Hugh, in your research and writing, you've disagreed with many of the liberal or left critiques of scientists who worked in these government laboratories. Let's start with your general take on the film and then talk about some of the specific issues that have been raised by critics and those who love the film as well.
So my general take on the film, it's a very accurate portrayal of the Manhattan Project and of Oppenheimer from everything I know about the Manhattan Project. I'm astonished that it's been as successful as it's been. 3 hours is a long time to sit without a break through a film. It's a very complicated film. It keeps jumping backwards and forwards in time. It has an astonishing array of characters, some of whom don't appear for very long. So I'm astonished, actually, that it's been as successful as it has. And I think it has to partly speak to a simmering disquiet that people have about the continued existence of nuclear weapons. I mean, I do remember this moment in the early 1980s when a number of movies came out, like The Day After and Threads and films like that, that spoke to a moment of immense anxiety about an arms race that was obviously out of control in the early 1980s when arms control negotiations between the US and Russia had broken down and all sorts of new weapons were being deployed. And I'm wondering if we're in a similar moment. We don't have a complete runaway arms race, but we have Putin threatening to use nuclear weapons in Ukraine. We have North Korea expanding its nuclear arsenal. There seems to be nothing we can do about that. India and Pakistan are engaged in a nuclear arms race. And the US is spending more on nuclear weapons R&D today than it did during the Cold War, an astonishing fact.
As well as the efforts to revive the nuclear power industry, another part of that history and its story that's not really taken up in the film. Well, do you think in terms of the narrative structure of this story and the anxieties attached to it when you revisit the history of the development of the atomic bomb, that focusing on a singular genius and his charisma and his rise and fall, denouement of the film, is limiting in a certain way. Of course, films depend on characters to drive the story, but you've worked quite a bit and carried out research as an anthropologist on the culture of these laboratories. Do you think there's anything lost or importantly obscured by focusing so much on the singular figure of Oppenheimer as the so-called father of the bomb, the most important man in history? You know, these kinds of statements are in the film itself.
You know, in terms of the way Hollywood sells tickets and draws people into movies, a dramatization of an anthropological study of lab culture would not earn back the money that was spent on making the film, right?
I don't know. I'd like to give it a try. Let's revisit that later.
So I think that a great Hollywood film director, and there's no doubt that Christopher Nolan is a great director, a very gifted director, and the depiction of Oppenheimer is an extraordinary piece of acting in the film. You know, there's no doubt that I think that was the only the only way that they could do this. And Oppenheimer is a fascinating character. I mean, he, more than any human being, made nuclear weapons exist. Much of the commentary I've read since has asked the very interesting question of whether nuclear weapons would ever have been brought into existence, had it not been for the fear that Hitler was going to get them, and then for Oppenheimer's single-minded determination to keep going, even when it was clear that the Nazis were not going to get the weapons.
His genius was not as a theoretical physicist primarily, but in some of his organizational skills. Is that correct?
Well, both. And from everything I hear, he had an extremely holistic intelligence. He had an ability to hold the organizational details of a laboratory in his mind and resolve them with one another at the same time. And he had an extraordinarily holistic intelligence capable of understanding the different aspects of the bomb design problem. This may amuse you or not, but a female nuclear weapons designer at Los Alamos once told me that women are much better at nuclear weapons design than men are because they think holistically. And that the way a nuclear weapon behaves when it explodes, you have so many things interacting with each other and changing the parameters of the event as it unfolds, that you have to have someone with an extraordinarily holistic intelligence to put all of that together. And there's no doubt that Oppenheimer had that.
You know, taking that idea of holistic thinking from gender differences into the left-wing politics, I think some of his complexity and moral torments were rooted in his left-wing sympathies that then were part of how we come to care about him and trust him with some moral compass, and his conflict around the horrors of this technology that he helped to give birth to, but then his fall during the McCarthy era. How do you see the arc of the morality tale in this film, particularly as I think it granted him quite a bit with his early communist sympathies, his leanings towards socialism, and then that as central to his tragic fall during the fever of the McCarthy era after the war?
I think part of the reason so much has been written about Oppenheimer, it's not just what he achieved, it's his Sphinx-like personality. I mean, I imagine that you could have 10 people come and watch this film with you, and you would have 10 interpretations of Oppenheimer at the end of it, right? There's an interpretation that he was arrogant. There's an interpretation that he was naive. Many people insist to this day that he was a Soviet spy. Most people insist that he wasn't. But still, people find evidence for both interpretations.
And my interpretation as a clinical psychologist was this guy was on the verge of a nervous breakdown all along. I thought it was interesting how he had a psychiatric hospitalization early in his adulthood and kind of fell apart during this aggressive interrogation during the McCarthy era. And that the question, why didn't he stand up for himself? Why was he so weak in standing up to this?
Well, so Kitty, his wife, asks him at one point, halfway through his security clearance hearing, she says, why aren't you fighting? And so as a psychologist, what's your interpretation of that? I mean, at the very end of the film, she gives an interpretation, which is that he felt so guilty about what he'd done that he thought he deserved to be punished. And he was sort of collaborating with his own disgrace.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering what you think.
Well, I think there might have been an element of moral masochism, is the term often used. And I think people who've struggled with hard problems throughout history can kind of fit that profile of submitting. You know, one person's moral courage is another person's moral masochism. And I think that he didn't do it very effectively. It was, I think, partly a product of a situation. He had tremendous support, including from the military, during his rise. And I think there's a maybe a part of him that could not believe that this was happening around him. And I think that often happens where people who've had developed a certain trust, including many of the people who are victims of McCarthyism, had risen to tremendous power and stature, and then are suddenly abandoned by the government that has relied on them and are persecuted by that same government. And I think we're seeing elements of that now, what people call neo-McCarthyism, where academics who've come into programs around racial and gender justice initiatives are attacked as being un-American. And it's very unsettling. And so I can see just situationally how he could fall apart under those conditions.
I think we're back to him being simultaneously very arrogant and very naive. I mean, he
vulnerable,
thought that because of what he'd done, he was immune. But he didn't see all the ways he was being used by the military. There's a scene in the film where Groves promises that Truman will tell Stalin about the bomb at the Potsdam.
Now, do you want to say who Groves was as a character?
General Groves was the general who built the Pentagon and then was put in charge of the Los Alamos lab and the Manhattan Project, and he picked Oppenheimer to direct the project. So he makes Groves promise that Truman will discuss the bomb with Stalin before it's dropped, and Truman doesn't, really. And Oppenheimer realizes that he's been naive, that he doesn't have the pull that he thinks he has. In terms of your original question about why focus it on one person, and is this person of interest, I try to imagine if Oppenheimer had had the personality of Groves, and if he'd been purely loyal, and he'd just done this amazing scientific feat, he'd pulled together these scientists, he never had any doubts about it, he glorified in what he'd done, and in as he saw it, ending the war soon by having the bomb dropped on Hiroshima, it wouldn't be half the film that it is, right? What makes it such an extraordinarily powerful film is this constant doubleness of Oppenheimer that leaves you perpetually perplexed about who he is. He's a man who's always having extramarital affairs, but a man of great integrity in other regards. You know, who is this man?
I think also the arc of the film as an American morality tale also raises the repressed history of U.S. scientists and our collective ties and indebtedness to communists in this country, who were major force in the 1930s around in the labor movement, in so many areas of the society, fighting for social justice. And you see this early on, his interest in social justice, and that drew him to the Communist Party and communist fellow travelers. And then during the McCarthy era, how this turns into an attack on him. And I think the film itself partly keeps in focus that issue of what is our relationship to the history of American communism and the contributions of American communists. And how does that figure into conceptions of loyalty? What's your take on that arc of the film as an American morality tale?
Well, there are very few films I can think of that portray American communists sympathetically. And a lot of the scientists in this film are communists or have communist sympathies, they're fellow travelers, if you like. Most of them turn out to be loyal Americans. Oppenheimer himself, when Hakon Chevalier in one scene tries to recruit him to spy for the Soviets, Oppenheimer says to him, "That would be treason." And he refuses to go along with it. As far as I can tell, he's a loyal American. So the film is interesting partly because there's this sort of side story where it is portraying these communists quite sympathetically. To me, the film really raised the question of how you judge the patriotism and loyalty of people you're giving access to classified information. All of the people who spied for the Soviets on the Manhattan Project were communists. There's no doubt that the military was right to be worried about communists working on this project. On the other hand, the vast majority of the communists who worked on it did not spy. The film mentions Klaus Fuchs, who was brought into the project by the British, and he spied for the communists. He gave the Soviets an actual design of the Nagasaki weapon. One thing we don't learn from the film about Klaus Fuchs that I think is very interesting, he was a refugee from Nazi Germany who settled in England, and the English immediately interned him. He was interned in Britain, and then he was interned in Canada. So did he spy for the Soviets because he was a communist, or did he spy for the Soviets because the country he tried to become a citizen of interned him? It's a very interesting question in my mind that the film doesn't address. It does show that there was a communist threat. If you follow the story in later years, before this conversation, out of curiosity, I went and looked it up and made a list of all the people who spied for the Soviets, who've been caught spying for the Soviets from the 1980s onwards. They all did it for money. None of them were communists. John Anderson Walker, Ronald Pelton, Aldrich Ames, Robert Hansen, Charles McGonagall, the CIA agents, NSA agents, FBI agents, they all did it for money. One of them, John Walker, was a John Bircher, but he spied for the Soviets. So there are all sorts of reasons why people can be disloyal. If someone is right-wing, you don't automatically suspect them. In fact, you trust them, but you shouldn't have trusted John Walker, right? So how do you determine whether someone's going to be loyal? It's a puzzle.
This is Jan Hawken talking today with Hugh Gusterson about the film Oppenheimer.
Musical clip was from a song called Enola Gay by Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark. Enola Gay was the name of the airplane that dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. We now return to Jan Hawken speaking with Hugh Gusterson.
Another arc in the film, kind of moral turning point, is where the bomb clearly is intended to be dropped on Japan rather than on Nazi Germany, and Oppenheimer himself evidences conflict and resistance to that, although he does end up following through and participating in the plan to drop those two nuclear weapons.
He doesn't just participate. He sits on the very small committee that picks Hiroshima and Nagasaki as targets.
So there is the tendency to redeem people if they've suffered a moment of conscience. You know, there's a kind of redemption or forgiveness if you've suffered, but go ahead and do it anyway. So there's that potential trap there. But how do you see the film's casting of the shift from Nazi Germany as a target to Japan? Because some scientists did oppose, who had worked on the the weapons project, dropping the bombs on Japan. And that isn't, as I recall, part of the story.
So there is one scientist who's not mentioned in the film who actually left Los Alamos as soon as the Nazis surrendered. He said, I signed up to stop the Nazis from getting to a bomb first. I'm out of here. There's only one, Joseph Rotblat, who went on to found the International Pugwash Association of Scientists trying to avert a nuclear arms race. My interpretation of why they kept going largely relies on a different film, the wonderful documentary film, The Day After Trinity, made by John Elsey. And he interviews a number of the Manhattan Project scientists for that film and asks them, why did you keep going? And you see them look bemused by the question almost. And they say, well, you know, we were working like 12, 14-hour days. We'd become so obsessed with solving the technical problem. It was just like momentum. It had become about itself at that point. We just couldn't stop. We were almost there. And for most of us, it never occurred to us to stop, because we were completely absorbed in solving this problem. And if I can sort of segue to my own studies of a nuclear weapons lab at Lawrence Livermore in the 1980s, I don't want to say that the scientists never thought about the ethics of what they did, because they did. When I asked them whether they thought about the ethics of their work, they said, almost all of them would say the same thing. They would say, "You're so lucky you're talking to me, because I really think about it, but my colleagues don't." So it was clear that they were thinking about it, but just not talking about it collectively. But when I got to know them, there's this sort of tunnel vision when a technical problem, a fascinating technical problem, takes over. And so the
and
scientists
has a lot of government money behind it.
Yeah. So the scientists, I think, got sucked into that tunnel vision. And I think it's striking to me that the petition to do a demonstration of the bomb and not to drop it on a Japanese city without warning did not come from the Los Alamos lab in New Mexico, which was almost like a cult at this point. It was totally cut off from the outside world. You couldn't leave and talk to people outside. It had just become about itself. That petition to do a demonstration came from an adjunct of the Manhattan Project in Chicago, where people were not quite as inducted into the cult. They had the benefit of other points of view of a normal social life, right? They weren't totally cut off from the world.
Well, I'd like to also talk about a part of the story of the history of these nuclear labs that goes beyond the film's own denouement, where you have the fall of Oppenheimer himself during the McCarthy era. But of course, these labs continue, and they continue for some time making nuclear bombs and also the nuclear material used in what Eisenhower called Atoms for Peace, you know, converting this industry that's associated with horror and destruction into kind of rebranding it as the power of the future. How do you see the ongoing life of these labs? I mean, that's a big topic, but is there anything critical that is left out by this closure? Because that's part of what stories do and films do, is they offer closure, but then, and of course you have to stop at some point. It was a very long, all 3 hours, but I think we can still use a film to keep open, to open the film's own closure to questions that haunt us to this day, both around nuclear weapons and nuclear energy.
Wow, where do I begin? I think there are, if you like, three key turning points in the subsequent history. And many of them happen after the film ends. But the first that the film could have done more with, Oppenheimer actually starts publicly advocating immediately after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. He publicly advocates putting nuclear technology under UN international control. What that meant to him under the Acheson-Lilienthal plan, which he largely wrote, was that uranium mining, processing, the production of nuclear material would all have been done by international bodies, that no national government would on its own have had access to that material. It would have prevented the Cold War arms race. The Russians would never have got nuclear weapons. Now, for that reason, it's thought by many historians that the Russians would never have gone along with this.
And also hydrogen bombs.
They would not have happened. So that's the first turning point. Oppenheimer loses the struggle to put the technology under international control. Not only that, but Teller and Lawrence, who are his antagonists in the film, go off and found a second nuclear weapons lab at Livermore in California, because they think Los Alamos is slow walking the hydrogen bomb. And as many people at Livermore told me, when they heard I was going to Los Alamos, they said, oh, you're going to Los Alamos. You should know that the Soviets are the competition, but Los Alamos is the enemy. And so there's a very real sense in which the arms race is between Livermore and Los Alamos. They're constantly competing with each other to outstrip one another. So that's the first turning point, where Teller and Lawrence's vision of what we do is victorious. They get a second weapons lab and a massive escalation of the arms race and the construction of hydrogen bombs. The second turning point comes in 1963, shortly after the Cuban Missile Crisis. Kennedy and Khrushchev realize they've almost blown up the planet. And they say, this is crazy. What are we going to do? And they discuss banning all nuclear tests. I cannot tell you how different our world would be today if there had never been a nuclear test since 1963. All the weapons designs that would not have been perfected. So the Russians refused to allow the on-site inspections that would have allowed a complete nuclear test ban treaty in 63. And so instead you had a limited treaty where underground tests continued to be allowed. And so the arms race continued, and the labs were quite comfortable with allowing underground tests. It didn't really stop business as usual for them.
And there's the ongoing health impacts that have been suffered, particularly by indigenous communities, the Navajo and other tribes in Southwest.
Well, once the tests go underground, you don't have that ongoing environmental effect from the contamination of above ground nuclear.
Like you did with the Trinity test.
Yeah. There's a third moment in the Carter administration when he comes close to negotiating a complete test ban treaty with the Soviets. And the director of Los Alamos has a private meeting with Jimmy Carter and talks him out of it. And so nuclear testing continued until it was ended by Bill Clinton. So the last U.S. nuclear test was in 92. The U.S. signed, and the Soviets signed, or the Russians signed, a test ban treaty in 1996, banning all nuclear tests. However, as the price for going along with that, the weapons labs insisted on more funding to maintain the stockpile than they had had during the Cold War. So the weapons labs now employ more people than they did for most of the Cold War. They have an elaborate program to stimulate nuclear testing instead of doing outright nuclear testing, which was their price for going along with the test ban treaty. So there have been actually four key moments where the arms race could have been ended, and it wasn't.
And I think another part of that story that I've tried to focus on in a recent film of my own on the history of nuclear power is the role of activists, anti-nuclear activists, and activists who were fighting to not only make nuclear power safer and eliminate it, but also the ban the bomb movement that was a real important force. And I think some are hoping to revive the ban the bomb movement, which is part of that history as well.
Well, there is a treaty, the Treaty for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, the TPPNW. That's been signed at this point by 85 different countries. None of the nuclear weapons states have signed it, and they try and pretend it doesn't exist. But there is now a global instrument that would ban nuclear weapons by treaty. And I think we live in a moment where, because of climate change and species extinction, the end of life as we know it is very much on people's minds. And I can imagine a revived movement against nuclear weapons that gets folded into that awareness. And this film may help provoke such a movement, one could hope.
So the film is very much worth seeing, if perhaps as most importantly for reviving public discussions on the legacies of nuclear weapons and nuclear energy that continue to pose threats to our collective survival today. Well, thanks so much, Hugh Gusterson.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, being with us today to talk about the film Oppenheimer and sharing your insights. I hope to have you on again. Maybe we'll watch that film you mentioned. What was the name of it?
The Day After Trinity.
Yeah, so maybe we'll revisit some of this terrain
And if your listeners are interested in another interesting film that came out last year, the documentary A Compassionate Spy is a documentary about Ted Hall, who miraculously was not prosecuted, although it was known that he spied for the Soviets. He was left alone by the U.S. national security state. And in the film, you see footage of him explaining why he felt it was his moral obligation to give the secret of the bomb to the Soviets. Makes for an interesting viewing.
Okay. Well, Hugh, we're going to have a little mini nuclear festival here on the radio and talk about them. I look forward to having you on again. Take care.